Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two verses and a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino.
And the Music Roadshow.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Music Roadshow. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for hanging out with us.
And thank you for being here, Scott.
Thank you for being here. Yeah. I just got here.
Yeah.
We'd love for you to join the conversation. Log on to facebook.com/TheMusicRoadShow and chat alongside with us.
Yeah, absolutely. You can do that either on Twitter, @TheMusicRoadShow, and like Scott mentioned, at Facebook, also The Music Roadshow. And after the show, you can hit us up on Instagram, @TheMusicRoadShow.
Actually, we're Instagramming live.
Are we?
Uh-huh. Intern Lisa has been Instagramming.
Shoot.
How do you think of that? Yeah.
Shut my mouth, or however they say
don't
that.
I wish.
Yeah. Hey, listen, in case you haven't heard, Dish subscribers, you can now watch us on TV because Blue Highways TV is now on Dish.
That's right. You can watch us 4 times a week on Channel 73 all over the country and for the first time ever right here in Nashville.
Sweet. All right, Scott, why don't you introduce this gentleman who's sitting here with us right now.
Okay, well, let's start with a question. I know, what were you doing of any significance when you were 17 years old?
17? Mm-hmm. I think I had just finished my last accordion competition.
Excellent, excellent. He was a chick magnet, let me tell
you. I was.
I had just
You know
read...
how they repel when you put them the right way?
Exactly.
That's the kind
it's
of magnet
a chest
I was.
Organ, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had just read the Lord of the Rings trilogy for the 13th time when I was 17.
Geek alert!
Right? our guest tonight had landed his first publishing deal when he was 17, and since then has written 10 number one songs, over 20 top 10 hits, and in 1 3-year period had between 50 and 60 cuts every year. 11 BMI Airplay Awards, 3 BMI 2 million Airplay Awards, and in his spare time, he has played as a session musician on many, many hit records and also produces artists. Songs on more than 50 million albums sold, from George Jones, Tammy Wynette, and the Oak Ridge Boys, to Fleetwood Mac, Diana Ross, and Trick Daddy. There is wisdom to be learned tonight, so best pay attention. It is an honor and a pleasure to say, Ray Van Hoy, welcome to the Music Row Show. We're glad you're here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here, guys.
All right.
What an intro.
I know.
That? I'm going to sample that if you don't mind and just put it on my phone. And
while there was all this activity going on, I didn't miss a beat. Did you?
Look at that.
Huh? That was great.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to go take a nap.
Doesn't take much. So what did your parents make of your decision to become a songwriter?
Well, my dad was actually instrumental in me being a songwriter.
All right.
For him, I wouldn't have been a songwriter.
Tell us about that.
I learned to play guitar at 10 years old. I just picked it up and started learning.
Yeah.
12 years old, I was getting pretty, you know, learning it pretty quick, and I decided I wanted to be in the music business, and that was it.
All right. So there was never anything else in the cards for you.
And that was it.
All right.
That was it. So when I was 15, I was getting, you know, kind of good.
Yeah.
Enough that I could play out and play around and do some different stuff and listen to Jerry Reed records and trying to learn all that stuff. I can't play like Jerry Reed though.
Yeah.
Still. But anyway, my dad, who was a letter carrier, postman at the time, is pretty much a Renaissance visionary guy in a lot of ways, but this is just one example. He said, you need to start writing songs. And I went, I do. He goes, yep. I went, really? He goes, yep, that's the thing. That's what's happening now, and that's what you need to be doing.
Wow.
I went, okay. And I said, okay, and I didn't do anything about it. And after about 3 weeks, he would come home with a piece of junk mail and a verse and a chorus and a verse and a chorus written on the back of a letter. Put it down and go, put some music to that.
Wow.
Really?
And so we became, he was my first co-writer and also the one who basically got me into songwriting before I even, you know, even resisted to do it.
Now, where was this? Where did you grow up?
In Bristol, Tennessee.
Okay. All right.
With the Holston Mountains in my, out my back window. It's like a postcard.
Wow. So then as you were figuring all this out, did you study or did you like pick apart other people's songs to figure out how it works, or how did you, other than what your dad was giving you, how'd you figure out the process?
Well, I was already listening to records to learn guitars.
Okay.
Simon and Garfunkel and James Taylor and whatever was out there, anything that had fingers style guitar in it. So I was already, you know, kind of studying all that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make up intros and do the music part, and I wasn't so concerned with lyrics or
those pesky words.
Yeah, exactly.
So Dad was bringing you lyrics.
Exactly. And so we started co-writing songs together, and then eventually, and then I bought a cheap little, or not a cheap, but the best recorder I could afford at the time, an old RCA reel-to-reel.
Wow.
And we bought a mic and set up a little home recording thing and started making tapes, and that's just what I did every afternoon, every night. And then after a while, I started going, well, I think I could write some words like this, you know. And so I started writing some of my own, and we'd write some, and I'd write some. And after a while, he said, okay, now we need to go to Nashville. I went, really? He goes, yep, we're going to Nashville, and we're going to knock on some doors and play these tapes for people.
Wow.
And my brother had just enrolled in, actually, we brought him down, the first trip, I think we brought him down to enroll in Vanderbilt. Just cold called people out of the Yellow Pages. And there was like tons of pages of people that had publishing companies, and, you know, most of them no answer. And so I'm, no, we don't want to see you. But a lot of people said yes, and a few people, and, you know, went over to see some people. And one of the first ones was Buzz Kaysen, who was one of the first guys in Berry Hill with Creative Workshop. And a guy named Milton Blackford was there, and Travis Turk was the engineer. And they said, look, we'll sign some of your songs as on individual song contracts. And then this will be your home when you come back. Hang out here. You got a studio you can use when you move down. I told them when I get out of high school, I want to move here.
Yeah.
When you move down, make it your home. Come here and hang out and be a part of the family. It wasn't like a publishing deal or any money, but it was just a home, which was
a
lot of encouragement
sometimes
for me at the time.
Wow.
It's like, wow, somebody actually let me in the door and asked me to come back.
That's awesome.
So what was the Nashville songwriting world like for a 17-year-old young man, or 18 when you got out of school and you came back? What was the atmosphere like for you?
Well, first of all, it was a lot simpler. You know, it wasn't as big business as it was now. Easier to probably meet people, although at the time it seemed pretty dadgum hard. Hmm. There are still people that it was hard to get a meeting with and hard to get into. Same old game, you know, who you know and all that stuff.
Right.
But looking back, it was like way simpler because Music Row was actually a community of people that went there and worked every day and made records. And now it's
in this like 3-block area,
pretty much. Yeah,
and had lunch together in places.
Yeah, and you'd run into them at the bar or at different places, and the studios were all there.
So if you were around, you'd know everybody.
You
eventually
were going to bump into somebody,
right,
some way or another. You know, usually if you were in that, you know, showing up every morning, which I was. But after my parents sold their house and moved here to help me get in the music business, and also to be here because my brother was here and my sisters wanted to make a move, but it was largely because of me too.
I'm really fascinated by this. So what was your brother going to school for?
Engineer. He's an
engineer.
A semi-retired, sort of not really, senior engineer at Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
And then your sisters?
My sisters both live in Atlanta.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so I'm just fascinated by your dad because, okay, this one's an engineer. This one, I need to smack him in the head and get him to start writing songs.
Exactly. Well, he was a drummer also.
Right.
Growing up, and a really, really good drummer in a band there that, you know, back then he'd make $50 a night on a weekend, which some people, that's what you make now sometimes in some places. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he was actually that and his regular job, he made good money and supported us when I was like tiny. He'd work all day and pack his drums up and play all night.
Wow.
So he knew the musician side of it, but I think he had always wanted to come to Nashville too and heard about it and, you know, intrigued with that. And so he kind of pushed me in that direction.
Sweet.
That is something else.
Supported me everywhere. I was lucky that I had family members that supported me so much because after I got here, I met people whose family would say, after they had hit records, their family would say, well, that's really sweet, honey. Now, when are you going to get a job?
Yeah, when are you going to get a real job?
Yeah.
Man. So but Nashville, I'm thinking, was kind of a tougher town back then, wasn't it? I mean, how would you compare it then to today's Nashville?
Well, it's different. It was different, but I think easier to meet people. It's still kind of easy to meet people.
I mean, just not just the music business, but just Nashville
in general.
The city
in general for a young guy.
You know, I liked it because I felt like it was a really big, small town.
Yeah.
You know, it was a big city from where I was from.
But like Lower Broadway wasn't the glamorous tourist spot it is now.
No, there was like a half a dozen, maybe. You know, Tootsie's was there. And yeah. There was a few of them there, but it was nothing like what it was. In fact, not for years and years.
Was it dangerous at the time?
I don't think so, really. I mean, there were parts of town that you could probably find trouble if you wanted to. I don't. it wasn't as tourist friendly probably as it was now, but I never thought of downtown as being dangerous.
Really. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it was just quieter, you know. It wasn't quite as.
Who were your mentors early on? And early on, what was the best songwriting advice given to you?
Well, I've been lucky because, as you know, nobody gets in the music business without help from other people. You know. And even though after some people get successful, they act like they did it all by themselves.
Yeah.
That's not the case, we know. But I had a lot of help from a lot of people. And one of my first mentors other than my dad was a guy named Curly Putman.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay.
And so soon after I moved to town, I heard that he was looking to sign writers and called up and made an appointment and played some songs for him. And that was my first publishing deal. He signed me 2 months after I moved here.
Wow. That's amazing.
And there was no money involved again, but I had a home. You know, I had a place to show up and write with Mike Kosser and Steve Pippen and some other writers that he had signed on there. And every morning I had a place to be and see what it's like to clock in, get your coffee and talk about it, look at the charts, see who's cutting and start learning. I had no clue about how the music business worked. At all.
Right.
Then.
Well, that's a great way to learn, though.
Yeah, it was the best college I could have gone to. Yeah.
Man.
Best
so
school.
I'm just curious, when you're experiencing all this, what was your first, oh my God, experience? Like, I can't believe this is happening to me.
Well, there was a lot of them, actually, you know, because a lot of things would happen and you'd meet people you'd think, I thought I would never meet that person. You know?
Yeah.
Like who? Who? If you can remember some of those.
Just an endless list. I mean, I was in a studio one time, and I had my guitar there, and Jerry Reed came in and needed to borrow a guitar.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, this guy was like a god to me.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought I'd never even see him in the flesh, you know. And so many people that liked it. I mean, the list is, you know. And right next door to where Greengrass Music was Curly's company, which was co-owned by Tree.
Mm-hmm.
Which eventually became Sony. There was a little house next door around on the corner where Curb is, and it was called the Country Corner. And it was literally one of those bungalow houses that was a beer joint. And they had a license to sell open can beer and a couple picnic tables in the back. And back in the day, Chris Christopherson and people, and I was never there when he was there. He was already gone. But people like that, Danny Dill, mm-hmm. I met there that wrote Long Black Veil and all kinds of people that I didn't know who some of them were. Curly'd have to tell me that guy's this guy.
Right.
Eddie Miller wrote Please Release Me. And
oh, wow.
People like legend people that when I was just a kid, I was just learning about who was who, you know. And looking back, it was like an amazing experience, you know.
How was Curly as far as, were you taking songs to him and was he critiquing him for you? And how was he as a song critiquer for you? What do you remember?
Well, he was really, well, first of all, he's a master songwriter.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you couldn't pick anybody much better than Curly to teach you how to write songs. And he wasn't so hands-on that, you know, he'd be listening every day, but we'd finish our songs and play them for him and he'd have suggestions to make and this and that. And, you know, so he had a lot of input on that with me and a lot of people, helped a lot of people.
So was he real detail oriented?
Sometimes.
Would he, you know, or was he more big picture for you?
Yeah, well, it depends on the song, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd go, you know, you could tell if he particularly liked a song that had something to it. I mean, back then I was writing songs that like I should have thrown away the first 200 of them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, some people that say the first song they wrote, they had a hit on. I go, the first song I wrote, I'd like to bury. You know, there was at one point when I re-signed with Tree, I asked Donna Hilly, I said, can I go through my catalog and erase some of those old songs so nobody ever has to hear them, you know, edit my past. But,
well, did you ever have one of those songs that you were later embarrassed by actually get cut? And like to your surprise?
Well, every time I got a song cut, it was a surprise. Actually,
good answer.
You know, and good grateful. Answer.
Well, let's take a quick break. Sponsor of this segment is Toyota of Cool Springs. Heino and I are both Toyota drivers. We love this dealership.
We do. They really go out of their way to give you an excellent experience, not only if you're purchasing a car, but also if you need to go get it serviced and that kind of thing. Unlimited time and miles warranty on every car, which is amazing, new and used.
Right.
3-day return policy. I mean, it's just a great place.
Well, check them out at toyotaofcoolsprings.com. Go see George, the owner. He's going to take good care of you on the web at toyotaofcoolsprings.com. We're going to be right back with more of Rafe Van Hoy on The Music Row Show.
Yeah.
Shop in Chicago on a sunny summer day. A couple gazes at the wedding rings, their own display.
She smiles and nods her head as he says, honey, that's for you. It's not much, but it's the best that I can do.
Golden ring,
golden ring,
with one tiny little stone.
Yeah, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's George Jones, Tammy Wynette doing Golden Ring, written by our guest this hour, Rafe Van Hoy.
Who just did a good version? Jamie O'Neill and for the love of cornbread, Andy Griggs did a really great version of that.
That's right, they did a great version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, and my co-writer on that was Bobby Braddock. And
that guy.
Yeah, that guy. And who is another mentor, friend.
Well, he and Curly had a bunch of hits together,
too. That's right,
yeah.
Tons of hits, great songs. And, to fall in that club with those guys was just like winning the lottery, to be honest with you. And that song there, I always tell people that Bobby was Tiger Woods and I was the caddy. except that's kind of an insult to Tiger Woods' caddy because that guy's a professional.
Yeah,
I was
just
trying to, learn then, so.
Well, so did you come with the idea, or?
It was Bobby's idea. George and Tammy had divorced at the time that they were like king and queen of country music, pretty much.
Right.
And their solo records were huge, and their duet records were huge. So after their divorce, nobody really knew if they were ever going to sing together again. Mm-hmm. So when they came up on the schedule that they were going to record, Bobby had an idea about wanting to write something about a ring. Or Golden Ring. So that was his whole concept. And actually, Curly was supposed to meet him that morning to write this song.
Oh.
And Curly didn't feel good or for whatever reason didn't come in, and I happened to be there.
Oh.
And so Bobby said, hey, Curly was going to be here, but you want to help me write this song? I said, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I love that.
So how's that for? I've had a lucky life, I have to say. So.
You weren't out there letting the air out of Curly's tires or anything like that.
No, if I had known, I might have tried to do something like that.
Well, before you sing a song for us, Tree Publishing, circa 1978.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just describe a typical day and evening in that building? Don Gant once said, "Enjoy this because there'll never be times like this again."
Yeah.
So just. I just want to close my eyes and have you explain what a day and night was like there.
Well, I was there the day he said that with a bunch of other people. But before Don Gant, of course, Tree was always, they were the hottest independent publisher in town for years. And Buddy had built it into, just a fantastic place. But when I first got there, it was kind of quiet. It wasn't the bustling thing it turned into. They had a bunch of huge writers, but nobody was really hanging around writing at the place. It wasn't a hub of activity. It's kind of, second floor was like filing cabinets and some secretarial stations and a couple of song pluggers. And and there was two other kids my age that had just been signed there that and to backtrack, I was at Greengrass Music, which is Curly's company, but after about a year, he decided he didn't want to be a publisher anymore, and he sold it back to Buddy. So we went with the package.
I see.
But the other two guys that were wandering around the halls that were my same age, and we were trying to figure out what are we doing here, was Jamie O'Hara and John Hyatt.
Oh, wow.
And we were both going, do we, because we kind of wrote country, but we kind of didn't, and we were just still trying to figure out where we fit in around there.
Right.
And we both had, all of us had some level of success in that thing, but not big success, you know, a cut here and there and this and that. And but when Don Gant came to Tree, it was like night and day. I mean, he tripled Tree's income in 3 years.
Wow. How'd he do that?
He did it. Well, first of all, he was, if you read about him, he was kind of a Renaissance guy too. He started off in music business when he was a kid and was in successful on many levels as an artist, as a producer. He worked at Acuff Rose. He was in Neon Philharmonic, the lead singer on Morning Girl. That was a big pop hit.
Wow.
He did tons of stuff. He, you know, because he worked at Acuff Rose, he knew the Everly Brothers, and he worked with Roy Orbison on some stuff and John D. Loudermilk, and he was just, you know, he'd done a lot of stuff before he was like very old at all. And by the time he came to Tree, I think he was like 31 or 32, right?
Yeah.
He was like a seasoned professional.
Right.
Produced hit records. He had already produced Jimmy Buffett's first four albums.
Man.
With Come Monday and all that stuff. So he was like on fire, you know. And he was a super passionate guy that just wouldn't give up, you know, and he believed in everything 100% and made everybody, he was like a great coach. He got everybody rallied to do stuff, but he would also call you if he thought what you were doing was wrong or BS, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came along, he went through everyone's catalog there and met with them one by one and told them what he thought about this song and that song and that song, listened to all their stuff.
Wow.
And did that, hired new song pluggers, some other song pluggers, and signed some other people. Alan Rohde was one of them.
Right.
I think he was there. And he just whipped it into, it was just on fire. And there was something, there were cuts happening like daily with somebody there by the time he got it all going. Of course, he knew everybody in town and could get songs to everybody. It was a great song plugger. And
that helps.
Yeah.
So then when all the other offices closed, what would happen at Tree?
So what happened is after things started kind of working, everybody figured out after about 6 months in that, hey, this is good. This is what we always wanted this to be and better than you ever dreamed it would be. Then, you know, it became a social event as well. And so then when people would do demos, you know, there'd be publishing going on during the day, meetings and so forth. And then at the end of the day, people would gather in Don's office and play their latest stuff, play the latest demos, the latest record they heard, they liked. It was just different people would be there, and it became more and more of a gathering spot. And then that would spill over to somebody's house, you know, so it was like work hard and play hard. And we wound up,
it was like a party every day.
We wound up, it kind of got a little out of hand towards the end a little bit. We had to put a lid on it a little bit, but we were getting a lot of great stuff done, and everybody was listening to everybody else's songs, and there was a real camaraderie and support system there for you. And it also was like the first time the songwriters in the round thing back then was called a guitar pool.
Mm-hmm.
And that was around before I came to town, but it kind of grew up there and in other places. And you'd have the heavy hitters that come in, Don's buddies like Mickey Newberry and Loudermilk and all the Sonny Throckmorton and Red Lane, and they'd sit in a circle and pass the guitar around. And when it got to you, you needed to have something that you could follow the last guy with. And there was one time I remember that I realized I didn't have anything to bring to the party. I went to the bathroom and never came back. You know, like, I got to go home and write. I got a woodshed and bring something that I can play in front of these people. So it was a, like, made you really want to drill down and try to come up with something
that's
better
awesome.
Than good, you know. Better
well,
than
we'd love good. To hear you play something if you feel like it.
Well, all righty. Let's see what this, I know we got us a kind of a acoustic electric thing going on here. Is that?
Yep, it's coming
yeah,
through.
Here. Yeah.
I could play, what do you think, Golden Ring?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. In a pawn shop in Chicago, On a sunny summer's day, a couple gazes at wedding rings there on display. She smiles and nods her head as he says, honey, that's for you. It's not much, but it's the best I can do. Golden ring with one tiny little stone waiting there, waiting there for someone to take it home by itself, by itself. It's just a cold metallic thing. Only love can make a golden wedding ring. In a little wedding chapel, later on that afternoon, an old upright piano plays that old familiar tune. Tears roll down her cheeks, and happy thoughts run through her head as he whispers low with this ring I thee wed. Golden ring, with one tiny little stone, shining ring, now at last it's found home. By itself, it's just a cold metallic thing. Only love can make a golden wedding ring. Now my joke I make when I play this live is that when a song modulates, it usually means there's something bad about that.
Uh-oh.
Like Big John where the mind collapses.
Something's going down.
And also, the original lyric says leaving town instead of running around. The original lyric was running around, but they made us change it back then because running around was too risque.
Oh.
So leaving town is actually a reason back then you could get divorced over, I guess. I don't know. In a small two-room apartment, as they fight their final round, he says you won't admit it, but I know you're running round. She says one thing's for certain, I don't love you anymore, and throws down the ring as she walks out the door. Golden ring, with one tiny little stone, cast aside, like the love that's dead and gone. By itself, it's just a cold metallic thing. Only love can make a golden wedding ring. In a pawn shop in Chicago, on a sunny summer's day, a couple gazes at wedding rings there on display. Golden ring. Thank you, George and Tammy.
Wow.
And Bobby.
Yeah.
I loved how you backed yourself up. You know, you're a great bunch of guys.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what.
You're the Renaissance man here tonight. He plays lead guitar. He plays lead vocals and background vocals all at the same time. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's hard to do the answer backgrounds, you see.
So how hard was it for you to acclimate to appointment writing, you know, and having to be brilliant, you know, at 10 o'clock every day?
Well, just learning to write, too. I mean, when I came here, I could write some songs, but they were not commercial or anything that would... There was nothing about them that was on the scale of something that could be recorded, you know. I did get some songs recorded fairly early.
Yeah.
But I kind of learned right away that I need to get my brain thinking the way these other guys are thinking to kind of, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So how did you go about doing that? I mean, what did you see them doing that was different from, you know, finding another way to rhyme whole with soul?
Right.
You know?
Well, in my mind back then, I guess my brain, I grew up listening to some country, but some pop stuff. And some of the pop stuff back then, the lyrics, you know, didn't have to be mega songs. Right. Some of them were, some of them weren't. I wasn't focused on that. I didn't realize how much emphasis there was on the structure of the lyrics and stuff until I moved here. Mm-hmm. But I pretty quickly figured that out.
Yeah.
And watching everybody else and, you know, and learning from co-writing. Can you learn from co-writing with other people?
By looking at their habits or seeing how they're getting to the next step in a song? I mean,
just all of it, really. I think when you write with somebody, especially when you're learning too, and you're always learning, but you hear how the other person thinks, so you can hear their brain working. You can absorb some of that, and they kind of the same way, I suppose. But it takes you long. Took me a long time to figure out some of those things because there's so many great writers that was around that, you know.
Yeah.
It takes you a while to get your head wrapped around how Bobby Braddock's brain works and how fast it works.
Right.
Man. Well, listen, we need to take a quick break, but I want to remind you that this segment is brought to you by our friends over at Dogwood Cabin Rental.
Right.
Scott, you were just in Gatlinburg or in Townsend.
I was just in Townsend this weekend because we played at the Snowdown. And Townsend, you guys, Gatlinburg is great. Townsend is on the other side of the mountain. It's the peaceful side of the Smokies. And if you want to get away from the rush, the tourists, and just enjoy the quiet beauty of the Smoky Mountains, go to dogwoodcabins.com. Book your cabin. Beautiful cabins. Amazing views. No crowds.
DogwoodCabins.com. Go check them out at DogwoodCabins.com.
There's something you got that really gets me going. It's hard to believe the way the feeling's growing. So let me say before my heart starts showing, only in it for the love. I want you to know you.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's John Conley doing a great song called I'm Only In It for the Love. And that was co-written by our guest here this hour, Rafe Van Hoy. You know, another one of my favorite songs of yours is Old Flames. All My Old Flames Have New Names.
Thank you.
How did that one come about? Because that's one of those I can listen to a million times and still cracks me up.
Thanks for saying that. That was a title idea that I had, and I was in the middle of producing an engineer at the same time, a lot of stuff, and I was just right in the middle of something I couldn't stop. But I had that idea, so I called Bobby Braddock up and gave him the idea and said, what do you think about this? He says, I don't know, let me think about it. And he called me back about 4 days later and played basically the first verse and chorus.
Oh, wow.
And then so while we were on the phone, we just talked about how you could make up funny names about some of the Old Flames, you know.
Sure.
And
Uzi.
Yeah. And just laughing and trying to make up funny stuff and stuff that you can't repeat that didn't make the song.
The final cut, yeah.
And we finished the song on the phone, and he demoed it, and Mark Chestnut cut it. So that was like the easiest songwriting ever.
Sure.
You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you're strapped on. How about one more song?
Okay. Would it be okay if I sing a new song?
Please. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
You mentioned I'm Only In It for Love, or that John Conley. That was the first song, or I don't know if it's the first song I ever wrote with Kix. It might have been.
Okay.
But it was his first number one song as a writer, Kix Brooks.
Okay.
And this is another song that we wrote just a few years ago, so after all this time.
Is the guitar coming through?
I don't have it on, sorry.
There we go.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, man.
Fuzzy sound to hear that.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Seems like all my life I've been living between here and there. Spending most of the time I've been given trying to get somewhere. Chasing one dream after another. Can't tell if I'm getting any closer. The rainbow's still one hill over between here and there. Used to be a walk through the backyard between here and there. Thought I knew all of the shortcuts the most anywhere. Then you find when you think you've made it, you just made it more complicated. The fast track is overrated between here and there. Time is what you make it, and there will never be enough. The best place you can hope to spend it is with the ones you love. You might find that your destination is all about the ride. Sometimes your heart will take you farther than your pride. Been down some good roads and bad roads between here and there. Lost a lot of good friends and good souls between here and there. I believe there's somewhere better. Someday we'll all be together. Makes you want to try and walk a little straighter between here and there. Chasing one dream after another. Can't tell if I'm getting any closer. Rainbow's still one hill over between here and there. Buzz tone going on there.
That's a great song.
I love that.
Sorry about the heavy metal.
No, that made it.
This segment brought to you by Judas Priest.
Jimi Hendrix.
Hey, stick around. We got lots more with Rafe Van Hoy. You're listening to the Music Row Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show.
Oh, hold on a minute, please. And lately, all I've been seeing are people throwing love away and losing their minds. Oh, maybe it's
that's
me
a great song. That's What's Forever For. That version's Michael Martin Murphy. That song's been cut by a lot of people.
It has been. I've been lucky. And you know, back in the day, you could have a song that was recorded by more than one artist.
Right. At the same time. Oh, sometimes.
Yeah. Well, Frank Sinatra would do it, and Tony Orlando.
I mean, at one time, if you had a hit, you're guaranteed to get a bunch of covers after that. Which
right.
is not the case now necessarily. But that song was recorded 9 times before Michael Martin Murphy's was the 10th recording of it that got released as a single before it was never a single on anybody.
Who else recorded it?
The first recording was England Dan and John Ford Culley.
Okay.
And Gary Morris, I can't remember exactly who they were, but I know that there were 9 recordings of it before them.
So this was a solo write for you, and I'm curious. There, every now and then I hear a song, and I just go, man, that whoever wrote that was feeling that. And so to me, that song has always been one of those. So you can either say yes or no,
yes.
That was just a 10 in the morning, I had to have a song in by noon type of thing.
No, actually, the story behind that one is, you know, it was that same era I was telling you about where, you know, you'd go home in the afternoon and you go, I've got to come up, give me something great, you know. Mm-hmm. I need something that's really special, and you're trying to really better what you've done and try to keep, you know, come up with something that somebody might think was important enough to get recorded and do well. And I'd had some success already, but I'm still just digging, you know, for some idea. And I remember going like a prayer, going, send me an idea, please, while I'm taking a nap. When I woke up a few hours later, I was remembering thinking about a friend of mine at the time who he and his wife were supposedly splitting up, and they seemed like the last people on the planet that would do that.
Right.
You know? And so I started thinking about that, and then it just, words started coming out, and I was trying to get them downstream of consciousness as quick as I could, you know. And originally I wrote What's Forever Good For?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there singing, I'm going, What's Forever? Wait a minute, I need to mark that out. Could you take that? Take that good out.
Take it out. Get your white out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's so awesome. I love that. So
it was kind of a gift, you know. Actually.
So these days, what lights your creative fire now, and how has that evolved over the years?
Kind of the same thing, I guess. You know, I just like ideas.
Mm.
You know, great ideas. And or if you're working with an artist or somebody who's a great singer and you get inspired to try and come up with something that fits them.
Sure.
I like writing for projects. I worked on, wrote with Kix Brooks on a movie he did.
About
a year ago. We did four songs on that soundtrack.
There was a song on YouTube I heard, I forget the name of it, but I was just like, man, that's a killer, killer song. That was good stuff.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. And it was fun watching the visuals of the movie while we were, you know.
Right.
Trying to come up with songs of project writing is kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, okay. We got 5 minutes here. Unfortunately, this has flown by. So, Trick Daddy, I'm a Thug.
Okay.
Yeah. What is up with that?
You have got to talk about that co-write, because that was between you and Trick.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Me and Trick, we're like this. I call that winning the Thug lottery.
Uh-huh.
There was a song I wrote before I had Golden Ring or any kind of real big hits. It was kind of a moderate hit with Barbara Fairchild called Cheatin' Is. And I don't know where it went to 12 maybe or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it got covered very quickly thereafter by an R&B singer named Millie Jackson, who I loved.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she sang great. I loved the way she sang. And so she did a reggae sort of version of it.
Okay.
And so anyway, I was at the CSAC Awards one year, and Julie, I was talking to a friend of mine, Julie Newton, and she says, you've got a rap hit out. And I went, I don't think so. She said, no, really, it's got your name on it. It's on the charts. I went, really? I said, that doesn't sound possible. And so the guy that was the head of the R&B division there, Aaron, I'm trying to remember his last name right now, I said, how is that possible? He goes, they could have sampled one of your songs. That's what happened. And so then I dug the song out and listened to it, and I'm thinking, what is that? What is that? And so they sampled a piece of Millie Jackson's recording and then wrote I'm a Thug over top of it.
Sure.
And they were. I was glad that they gave me credit, because if they hadn't told me, I would have never known. You know, never picked it out.
Well, good
wow.
for you.
You know, that's so that
awesome.
Was just like, thank you.
And that melodic part of the chorus is actually,
I don't know.
It's good.
It's
actually kind of catchy.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So now, you know, if you could give yourself, your current self, give your former self some advice back then, what do you wish you advice you would have gotten?
If I could go back in time?
Yeah, and give yourself.
I would say, when you're in this lucky period and you got this, you're in this lucky spot that you don't even know how lucky you are,
mm-hmm.
you need to write about four times as many songs. Work harder. Because I worked pretty hard, but I could have.
You could have done more.
Yeah, always could.
You were so young, though. I mean, I imagine once you start rolling, you're kind of.
Well, also.
You're a thug, man. You're a thug.
Well, at the time, too, you know, if you haven't lived much, it's hard to think of different things to write about. You know, you're looking at other people's lives, trying to
imagine
inside their brain and their life to try and write things. So it's like Bobby Braddock says, songs come from life, pretty much. So,
yeah.
Hadn't lived enough to really have a deep catalog of experiences and ideas to draw from. So,
right.
You know.
Hugh Prestwood said one time, he's like, if you want to be a hit songwriter, you know, get married, get divorced.
Right.
Now you're ready.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Right. And then play the song backwards.
And play it backwards. Yeah. Well, that's great. We're running out of time. I don't know if I have any short questions here.
you don't never have any short questions.
What's the biggest change to the industry from the viewpoint of a songwriter since 1978 to now?
Well, the obvious one is that, you know, when they were working out the streaming royalties, somebody should have been thinking a little bit further down the track.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if somebody said that I want to sell oranges, but I'm going to get them out of the guy's grove and not give him anything for them, that yeah. business model wouldn't exist.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So somebody should have been a little bit more forward thinking on that. That's a big change.
Well, when we find
who gonna
that
happen.
Someone is.
Technology was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
We need you to come back. Will you come back and see us?
Absolutely.
I'm spending the night.
Yeah, don't leave. We'll just do a whole other hour.
I'm going to go get some whiskey, and I'll be right back.
All right. You don't have to go. I got some.
Oh, okay.
TheMusicRowShow.com is the website. Go visit us. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week on The Music Row Show.